Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Stealing valuable art seems to be something one only sees in the movies or in the context of history, but it is much more common than many would think. Billions of dollars in art and cultural artifacts are stolen each year, and it's a unique crime, too. There aren't many buyers of stolen art on street corners or in pawn shops. The FBI formed an art crime team in 2004, and our guest today is the founder of that team and also author of the book, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, former FBI art crime team leader, Robert Whitman. Mr. Whitman, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Scott. It's my pleasure.
If you have a question or a comment, this is a topic that doesn't get a lot of attention. We'd like to hear from you if you have a question or comment about the theft of art or artifacts. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So the art crime team formed by the FBI in 2004 and put into service in 2005, how did that come to be?
Well, Scott, what happened was throughout my career, I started at the FBI in 1988, and I started working art crime almost immediately by investigating two thefts in Philadelphia. I was actually stationed in the Philadelphia field office. And those thefts, one came from the Rodin Museum downtown, and the other one came from the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Art, Archaeology and Anthropology. And after being able to solve those two particular crimes, I started working art crime throughout my career. I went to the Barnes Foundation for a year of art study with the FBI's approval, and as a result of that and other kind of training, I became like the subject matter expert throughout the country for art and jewelry theft. So around 2004, I had just done a case in Copenhagen, Denmark. I worked in 22 different countries. And in that particular case, we were able to recover a stolen Rembrandt, which was stolen at gunpoint from the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. And when we got back, I looked around and realized that there was only two people in the United States who actually worked art crime. And it's a big industry. I mean, that's what people have to understand, that the $200 billion art industry in the world every year, it creates many, many jobs. It's a large economic engine, but there's about $6 billion of that which is actually illicit cultural property: it's theft, frauds, forgeries, and fakes.
That
so
Rembrandt,
big business.
That Rembrandt you were talking about was a Rembrandt self-portrait that was painted in 1630. I mean, I think, again, what you just described may surprise a lot of people that the FBI would be working in 22 different countries, but it seems as though what you're also describing is there are so few experts, not just in this country, but around the world that deal in art theft.
Well, that's true, but the thing is this. The United States has 40% of the art market, or an $80 billion industry. We're the largest consumer country in the world when it comes to art, collectibles, and cultural property. But we have the smallest group of investigators. In London, you have the Antiques and Art Squad at Scotland Yard. It's an entire squad. In Paris, there's 36 investigators in what they call the OCBC. And, in Italy, there's 300 investigators with the Carabinieri. In the United States, back in 2004, we had two. So we definitely needed an upgrade. So we went to headquarters and we were able to start the team.
It almost sounds, when you talk about it that way, that it wasn't a crime that was taken very seriously here in the United States.
Well, it was considered a property crime, which is very low on a priority list for the FBI. I mean, there is a certain priority list, and art crime was probably the fifth level below the lowest level. So property crime is not considered a priority. But I always looked at it from the standpoint that when we talk about art and cultural history, it's an entirely different type of crime from, say, stealing a car, say. You know, stealing a Manet is not like stealing a Chevrolet. Two different things. and consider they have much more impact than, you know, normal property crimes.
So in my introduction, I described this as something that a lot of people here in the United States probably have only seen, I mean, you've heard news reports, but we hear it most often in the movies, or, you know, there's been a lot of attention to the Nazis and Hitler in World War II and stolen Jewish art. But give us a sense of just how widespread this is. I mean, this is, as you described it, a multi-billion dollar business. Talk about just how big it is.
It's worldwide. It's like I say, it's the fifth largest criminal enterprise according to Interpol. So it's a $6 billion, you know, illicit industry. So yeah, it is huge. And as I said, because we are, the United States is the largest consumer country, we are the engine that runs the train to a certain degree in creating, not creating, but making this crime profitable to certain people. But it's interesting today, theft is not the major part of the crime. It's more theft, it's more frauds, forgeries, and fakes. What we see today is a lot of fraud. And I would tell your listeners to be very careful if they see a good deal. What I always say is, you know, if you're going to buy a Picasso on eBay, just make sure there's two S's in Picasso. And that there's no A in Monet, you know. So just be careful of that, because fraud is rampant.
I mean, have those things occurred where, you know, the names of famous artists have been misspelled?
I've seen it all.
Really?
I've worked in this business for 30 years, and since I retired from the FBI in 2008, I've run my own company, Robert Whitman Incorporated, and we get involved in all types of frauds, forgeries, you know, different situations. Do a lot of expert witness testimony. I saw a $5 million Jackson Pollock painting sold where the Pollock was spelt wrong when the person signed the title. You know, that's kind of a clue as to authenticity, you know, to think that the artist couldn't even spell his name right.
And I know you're joking about a lot of this, but is there or are there actually people who are advertising what they say are valuable pieces of artwork on eBay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's no knock against eBay. eBay is merely the platform. It's the people who are on the platform who are putting these things together. I had a case involving an individual from Wisconsin who bought $300,000 worth of American art. He bought many, many paintings, 25 paintings from around the country from different sellers. And when he went to monetize those paintings, he found out they were all fakes. And it's very difficult then to go after, you know, 25 different galleries in 5 or 10 states, you know, with a lawsuit, because how do you get that done? That's very difficult. So it's it's something that you have to really be careful. If the deal's looking too good, then listen to your mom, because it's probably not real. Mm. She would have told you that, you know. It's common sense.
If you are just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Robert Whitman. He's the FBI's Art Crime Team founder and the author of the book, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, also has his own company. If you have a question or a comment about art theft, cultural property theft, and we just heard a lot about frauds and other fakes that are out there as well, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, we'll talk a little bit more about the frauds and the fakes out there. But when art is actually stolen, and I don't want to give anyone any ideas, but how does it actually occur?
Well, many different ways. I mean, there's individuals who go in and can do shoplifting in galleries. They actually go in and steal the painting and run out the door. Or there's individuals who go into museums. Usually, we found, Scott, that 89% of all the solved museum heists in the United States were committed by insiders. And that's really interesting. Think about that a minute. 89% of the time, someone who had the keys to the kingdom actually was the person who was doing the stealing. So whether it was a curator or a guard or a maintenance man or even, you know, an expert going in and studying, those are the things that you have to look out for when you work, say, in a museum. So it depends on the situation. There's also just the armed robberies. I mean, that's fairly uncommon in the U.S., but happens many, many times in Europe. There's a lot of armed robberies of museums and galleries and cultural spaces.
So when art or artifacts are stolen, I assume that most of the time the thieves, what they want to do is resell this to try to make some money off of it. Is there a market for that? How does someone go about selling stolen art, and who buys it?
Well, that's the question. I mean, throughout my career, I've seen that they've always tried to monetize it. That's the whole purpose. The reason that they steal the art is because the value has gone up so much in the past 50 years. So they read the articles about a Picasso selling a Sotheby's for $50 million, and they think to themselves, well, it's a lot more than a Chevrolet, so if I go steal the Picasso, I could make a lot more money. Problem is that they're better thieves and criminals than they are businessmen. They don't realize that the stealing of an artwork, it's not the art in an art heist is not the stealing, it's the selling, Scott. So what happens, they always get caught when they bring it to market. That's how we recover most everything when it comes to market, either through, you know, a generational sale, or it goes to auction and we recognize it's stolen, or, you know, when they try to sell it to an undercover police officer like myself. And at that point, it's when they're trying to monetize it, that's when we get it.
Tell me about that. I mean, because that's, you know, when your book, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, there must have been some real drama over the years as you were undercover. Tell us about some of the cases.
Well, there's been, I probably chronicled maybe a dozen different cases that I had done throughout my career. It's a memoir. It's called Priceless, How I Went Undercover. The tagline is How I Went Undercover, but the name of the book is Priceless. And it's a New York Times bestseller. It talks about different cases, one in Spain that we did involving $65 million worth of art, another case we did in Paris involving two Picassos that were stolen from the granddaughter of Pablo Picasso, and we recovered another case that we did involving artwork out of the Nice Museum in Nice, France, where we recovered those pieces in Marseille at gunpoint again. But we also talk about other things. You know, it's interesting, Scott, because throughout my career, not just artwork, but also cultural property. I mean, I at one point I recovered a 3-pound piece of gold, the largest piece of gold ever found in a tomb in the Americas. It was stolen, looted from a tomb in Peru. And we actually did an undercover operation. We were able to recover that in Philadelphia as it was being sold to us. It was a 2,000-year-old artifact that had been buried in the tomb and had been stolen back in the late 1980s. And as a result of their attempt to sell it, again, bring it to market, we were able to recover that. So it's not just artwork. It's also cultural artifacts like Peruvian culture from Iraq, different pieces from Africa. So it's cultural property from throughout the world.
And, you know, we have heard a lot about that with the war in Iraq, the different with ISIS in particular, destroying, thousand-year-old artifacts. And, you know, I mentioned Hitler and stealing art from the Jews in Europe. It seems that war would just be ripe for the stealing of artifacts and the stealing of art.
Yeah, that's correct. During the Second World War, probably they say that 3/5 of all the art in Europe changed hands during wartime. So it's a very prevalent situation as far as that's concerned. I did a second book in 2016 called The Devil's Diary, Alfred Rosenberg and the secrets of the stolen secrets of the Third Reich. And then that was a book about a case we did for the U.S. Holocaust Museum in 2013, where we recovered a diary, a 400-page diary, that was written by Alfred Rosenberg, who was the chief philosopher and civil scientist for Adolf Hitler. In many respects, that's the man who made Hitler into Hitler when he met him in 1919, very early on. So if it wasn't for Rosenberg, all those situations that we saw, the theft of the artwork, the Holocaust itself, these things may not have occurred because Rosenberg, they were his idea as the philosopher. So we recovered that piece and wrote a book about that and talked about what was actually in the diary. It was important because it had never been transcribed or translated. So this 400 pages, which was actually recovered by Patton's troops in 1945, was used at the Nuremberg trials, and Rosenberg was one of the first 10 war criminals who was hung as a result of convictions at the Nuremberg trials. It was interesting because it was stolen by one of the prosecutors who brought it back to Philadelphia, believe it or not. And it stayed here in this area, the Philadelphia area, for the next 70 years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Robert Whitman, the FBI's art crime team founder and author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we go to the phone, I want to remind you, you can see some of the shows that we're working on here in the near future. Slavery at Dickinson College, that's an exhibit that's coming up, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. Getting a handle on ticks to control Lyme disease, and the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail to see what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we are talking about art theft, cultural property theft with Robert Whitman. Let's take a phone call now from Becca in Harrisburg. Becca, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thank you. My question is whether Robert has read Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. The backdrop of the novel is essentially the subject of today's Smart Talk, art theft. And of course, what he thinks of the novel and whether it's realistic and the efforts to recover the stolen piece of art.
It was a great book. I did read it, and I thought it was very interesting. They did use some of the techniques that we do use to talk about recovery, and I would recommend that book to anyone who's. But it is, of course, it is fiction. That's fictional. It's not nonfiction, but it is an interesting look at it. There's a lot of great books out there about art theft. And I think some of the fictional ones are pretty good. They can do things, you know, in their imaginations that we can't do in real life. So I think it's fun to read these things.
Let's go to Irene in Red Lion. Irene, you're on the air.
This is Irene.
Irene, I'm sorry.
And that's okay. I'm a retired rare books librarian, and I wondered what Mr. Whitman knows about, you know, how widespread is rare book theft. There was a case in at the Carnegie Library a couple of years back that made a lot of press, but just how widespread is it?
Thank you very much for your call. Mr. Whitman?
Yeah, books and manuscripts and rare documents is a common they're a common victim of theft. Probably every couple of years, it seems to me, every couple of years, I can remember, another person's been caught having gotten into, like, the National Archives to steal Lincoln letters, that type of thing. Throughout my career, I had many cases involving stolen literature. I recovered the original first draft of the Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck. I recovered the first printing of Shakespeare's folios that were stolen from the University of Manchester. Many books and rare items of literature. In fact, like I said, we recovered the 400-page diary of Alfred Rosenberg that was stolen. So it's a very prevalent situation with stolen books and documents. And many times when these things are stolen before they're transcribed and translated, we lose more than just value. We lose information, and that's even more important. That's even more valuable than just dollars. It's actually the information within these types of these books and manuscripts. So, yeah, I appreciate you calling in and bringing that up, because that is a large part of the cultural property protection that we endeavor to do at the FBI and now with my company.
Something else, when you talk about a valuable and historic document that you recovered, this was headline news here in the United States a few years ago, I guess it was more than a decade now, but theft of one of the original 14 copies of the Bill of Rights that was actually stolen by a Union soldier in April 1865, but returned to North Carolina in 2005, a value of $30 million. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, that came out to be $100 million.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it turned out, because I actually did that case in Philadelphia. It was being offered for sale at the National Constitution Center when the Constitution in downtown Philadelphia was just opening up. So Mayor at the time, Governor Rendell, wanted to try to get a crowd stopper to put into the Constitution Center as an opener. And he was offered that piece for $4 million by a pair of brokers. One of the individuals was from the Antiques Roadshow, believe it or not. And so these people had found this piece that was being offered for sale in Indiana. They paid about $180,000 for it, and then offered it to the National Constitution Center for $4 million. But, of course, it was stolen from North Carolina. It was a property of the North Carolina, the people of North Carolina. So we did an undercover operation there as well. And as a result, we were able to recover that piece in a law firm in downtown Philadelphia when it was being offered for sale. And it went through a pretty lengthy judicial proceeding where it was recovered and given back. It's now in the archive. It's one of only 14 in existence that were created by George Washington and his scribes back in 1789. It was actually the Bill of Rights. And, you know, when you become an FBI agent, you swear to uphold the Constitution, but I never thought I'd actually hold it in my hand.
What is that like?
I mean, situation.
You know, some of the items that you're talking about are just so classic. When you get to actually hold them in your hands, I mean, do you ever stop and think, I can't believe what I'm holding in my hands?
Yeah, usually I'm wishing I had a pair of gloves.
I would imagine.
Yeah, but it is an amazing feeling. I mean, for a moment, you had this eureka moment that, you know, you finally recovered exactly what you were trying to get. You know, these cases are like tigers, and you grab them by the tail, and it takes you all around. You never know what country, where it's going to end up. In some cases, I worked four or five different countries to recover something. And you never know where you're going to go. And when you finally get it, it's a eureka moment of, like, you're walking on air for a second, you know, when you finally recover the piece. It's a funny feeling, though, but after it's over, there's a big letdown. I mean, there's a few minutes where the, you know, adrenaline goes away, and then it's a big letdown because you got to start all over again on the next case. And that's where you start up again and get the energy and keep going. So, yeah, it's a really great feeling. You know, I had a great talk a couple of weeks ago at the Samick Art Gallery in Lewisburg at the...
At Bucknell, yeah.
Bucknell. Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted to tell your listeners, they should definitely go to see the art at the gallery. They're really lucky to have a wonderful spot to go to there and take a look and enjoy that that gallery. They've done a great job there. Rick Reinhart runs it, and it's an excellent place. We had more than 300 people come to the talk. And just to let you know, on November 6th, I will be at Susquehanna University again for another talk. And that'll be on the evening of November 6th. So.
Okay. Well, but and that's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the program, knowing that you were going to be speaking in the area, had spoken in the area. We'll be speaking again at Susquehanna in November. Do you have a case that, I don't want to say your favorite case, but one that really stands out to you, maybe was the biggest challenge, and when you finally did recover the item that you really felt good about it?
You know, you go after all these pieces, and, you know, it's an interesting thought about the value. Some people talk about, you know, that $100 million Bill of Rights. If you could sell it, it's probably the second most valuable document in U.S. history. The only one to be more expensive would be the Declaration of Independence, because that's only one of those. But this is the second most. But, you know, when we talk about value, there was a case I did which involved a battle flag. And that battle flag was carried by African-American troops in the Civil War. And it was the first time that these African-American troops could actually go into a battle as U.S. soldiers. And, you know, it was at the Battle of Port Hudson. Five of them were shot out from under the flag as flag bearers carrying the piece because it was an honor to carry that flag. And it was a regimental flag. It was stolen back in the 1970s from the Army. And was being offered for sale in Kansas City. So we actually did an undercover operation there too again, where we were able to recover that momentous flag, that very, very, you know, very, very historic piece that represented the freedom of these individuals and their children and their grandchildren for all time. And it was only valued at about $30,000. It was being sold for, but the historic value was 100 times that, you know, as far as the, you know, the value to community and culture. So, you know, recovering items of cultural history sometimes are not as valuable financially, but they have the historic significance. And I always looked at both and thought both were just of equal importance.
We have an email from a listener, Anne, who says, I lived across the street from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum on Fenway in Boston when that museum was robbed sometime around 1986. Has that been resolved? Last I heard, it was in private hands in Ireland.
Okay, the biggest art heist in U.S. history was from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in 1990. And at that time, 13 pieces were stolen. Two individuals dressed as Boston police officers. They tricked the two young guards, well, the two guards who were there. The guards let them in. Of course, they were thieves, not police officers. They tied the guards up, and they made off with 13 items of art. One of them was a Vermeer. It's one of only 30-some-odd in the world that's missing. It's the only one that's missing. Total value of that particular painting right now is about $300 million if it could be recovered in good shape. Also, Rembrandt's Degas, a number of other pieces. In fact, one of the Rembrandts is the only known seascape Rembrandt ever did. All those pieces are still missing. It's been, how long now, what, 28 years? And none of those pieces have been recovered. Interestingly enough, there is a $10 million reward for information on recovering these pieces. So if any of your listeners have any idea where they're at, tell them to give us a call. We'll work together with them. Robert Whitman Incorporated, my website.
You know, after listening to you today, I have to say that if we have anyone out there that does have valuable art pieces or artifacts or historic items, they may want to keep them in a way that they're a little bit safer and a little more secure. When it comes to private collectors, when it comes to museums, what can they do?
Well, we actually offer site security surveys. We go into museums and institutions and galleries, and we give them surveys on how to protect their art, to identify what they're doing wrong or what the situation is. We work with the museums to do transportation as far as for security is concerned. So we do get involved in all that, and it's layered security with different layers of different types of security that you have to have in to have a good system. A system's not made of one thing. It's made of a number of different layers of operational security. So I would say to your listeners, if you have a valuable collection, you know, it's a good idea to look into that to try to make sure that you're secure as you can be, especially if it's a gallery or a museum as well.
You know, what's kind of ironic about it is that these are things that people enjoy, and you want to show them off. You want other people to enjoy them as well, to see them. Maybe not touch them, but be close to them. And when you do that, there's more potential for miscreants out there.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's always the perplexing situation in a museum. I mean, you want the visitor to have the best possible experience, and yet you still want to have the top security for your artifacts. So, about 65% of every dollar that's paid out by the fine art insurance industry is for damage. It's not for theft. So it really is a situation where damage can be as critical, you know, for artwork as theft or anything like that. So it is something important to try to keep your material safe and sound.
Robert Whitman is the FBI's art crime team founder, is the author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, and other books as well. Mr. Whitman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Listen tomorrow for Smart Talk, where we discuss an exhibit on slavery at Dickinson College, slavery overall at the college. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The phrase ethnic cleansing became widely used in the 1990s to describe a conflict unfolding in the Balkans after the country of Yugoslavia disintegrated and the Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina declared independence. Long simmering ethnic tensions rose to a crisis point. Bosnian Serb forces began a campaign to expel all Bosnian Muslims and Croatian civilians, resulting in the murder and disappearance of thousands of individuals, mostly men and boys. In the years after the war, an international criminal tribunal was established to prosecute Bosnian war crimes. One particular trial made headlines this week when PBS Frontline program produced a documentary on the notorious general accused of genocide and war crimes. The Frontline program was the trial of Ratko Mladic. Mladic, there we go. Joining us today is one of the lead prosecutors in the trial of Bosnian Serb war criminal Ratko Mladic. It is Penn State Dickinson School of Law professor Dermot Groom. Mr. Groom, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott, and thank you for inviting me to appear on Smart Talk.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, before we get into how you became involved in this case, just want to kind of remind the listeners, because it has been 20 years or so, who was Ratko Mladic?
So Ratko Mladic was the commander of the Bosnian Serb army. And you said in the intro that one case made the news this week. Actually, another case made the news as well yesterday.
I saw that, yes.
The president, Radovan Karadzic, his appeal was decided, and the appeals chamber decided that his sentence was too low, and he was given a life sentence yesterday.
Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit more about Mladic.
So Mladic came up through the ranks as a soldier in the Yugoslav army, as ethnic tensions began to dissolve Yugoslavia. Slavia, as we knew it previously, he became a person who appeared willing to commit crimes during the course of this dissolution. On May 12th of 1992, he acknowledges that what is going on with ethnic cleansing really is genocide, and becomes a full participant in what happens for the 3.5 years of the war.
In legal terms, what's the definition of genocide? I'm going to be jumping around by you when I hear these when you hear these questions.
Okay, so genocide would include a number of acts. Let's take the most serious, murder. So murder in the U.S. is typically defined as if you kill someone intentionally. Well, genocide is that plus a special intent. And the intent is to kill in whole or destroy in whole or in part a protected group, such as an ethnic group or a religious minority. So the victim in genocide is not the individual. The victim is the group.
In this case, it was Muslims. Why were Muslims targeted?
So in this particular case, Bosnian Muslims more specifically, and it has to do with the dissolution of Yugoslavia, and particularly Bosnia. It was an several ethnicities living in Bosnia. They were intermingled, and in the dissolution, the decision was taken by Milosevic, the president of Serbia, and other prominent leaders. Well, let's reorder the demographics of Bosnia. Let's remove Muslims and Croats, non-Serbs, and replace them with Serbs. And in doing that, as Mladic clearly recognized in May of 1992, people are not going to simply leave the farms that they lived on for generations. They will resist. And the only way to remove them from their property would require genocide.
So we're going to talk more about what you saw, how you prosecuted the case, but how does one become, I know that one of your specialties is international law, but how do you become a prosecutor at The Hague and the International Court for a case like this?
So I was a prosecutor. I began my career as a prosecutor in Manhattan and did that for about 6 years. I then started doing human rights work in other countries. When the Security Council established this court in 1993, it really was the cutting edge of criminal justice, that we were now going to hold leaders of countries, leaders of militaries accountable for atrocity crimes. I, like many others, was very interested in participating and contributing to this effort and applied to work there and eventually was hired. And my first case was to lead the investigation of Slobodan Milosevic.
Mm-hmm. So how is it different when trying a case on the world court internationally as compared to, say, in Manhattan?
So the fundamentals are the same. I still have to prove every allegation beyond reasonable doubt. So in Manhattan, a murder trial might last a week. Mladic, we charged him with tens of thousands of murders. I have to prove those individual murders beyond reasonable doubt. So the scale is very, very different. And the time is much more limited. So the scale of the case is just so much bigger than an ordinary domestic case.
As I said a little bit earlier, before before Mladic was even captured. I mean, it was a while before he was on the run, and before he was even captured, this investigation was going on. And you witnessed some of the atrocities. I mean, the Frontline documentary shows that visually, and it's heartbreaking, it's shocking. But what are some of the things that you saw during that investigation that you just said to yourself, what were these people thinking?
Obviously, I mean, I've dealt with some of the most traumatized people imaginable, people that have suffered greatly in these crimes. But I've also seen the best of humanity as well. So the Frontline piece starts out with the evidence of Elvin in Passage, whose father and his village was attacked by Bosnian Serbs. His father and uncle were ultimately killed by thugs. So we see the worst of humanity there. But it's also a beautiful love story in the decisions that his mother and father made. He was a 14-year-old boy. What they did to save his life, the sacrifices they made. So, yes, there are some awful things that I've witnessed, but I also consider myself very privileged to have seen the best of humanity as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that young man was, how old is he now, by the way?
In his 30s.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, I thought he was in his 30s. By the way, just to talk a little bit more about the Frontline documentary, it aired the other night on WITF-TV. It will air again in the future. Don't have an exact date. But if you go to WITF.org and PBS's website, PBS.org, you can see video of the Frontline documentary, The Trial of Ratko Mladic. In fact, just to give you a little taste of this, here's the promo that aired a little earlier this week.
Tonight on Frontline, a man accused of the worst crimes in Europe since World War II, General Ratko Mladic, one of the most notorious figures from the wars in the former Yugoslavia, finally goes on trial. Filmed over 5 years with exclusive access to the prosecution and defense and the witnesses who came to testify.
When more than 1,500 people are murdered in a short time and thousands more starved, degraded, tormented, the word for those crimes is genocide.
The trial of Ratko Mladic.
That 30-second promo provides and it gives you a taste of what the documentary was like. But 5 years, you had those cameras around, 5 years, that is unprecedented that there would be a crew, a camera crew in there while you're doing this. But just talk about it from your perspective. What was happening during those 5 years?
I'm happy to do that, Scott. But if I might make a comment about the Frontline documentary and its particular relevance to central Pennsylvania. So it focuses very much on the crimes in Srebrenica. There are actually a significant number of survivors of that genocide living in Carlisle in central Pennsylvania. So some of our neighbors, the people, our co-workers, are actually depicted in the crowds that we see so desperate when Mladic descends upon Srebrenica. Now, to go back to your question about the time and the access that we gave them, I was extremely reluctant in the beginning when they proposed this, partly because these witnesses are so traumatized, and I see part of my role as a prosecutor is to try to minimize any further traumatization in the judicial process. Having said that, they're two very respected directors. They have done a number of criminal documentaries based on criminal cases before, and I came to have confidence that they would be very sensitive to the particular needs of the witnesses. So we granted them access on the condition that all the witnesses knew in advance and were able to make informed consent. The other reason I agreed to it was because there were some misconceptions about our work as international prosecutors, and I thought it was a good way of educating the public about exactly what we do when we bring these large cases before international courts.
And I think that the documentary does show, and it is very educational, but does show what you have to do to prove the case. They also had access to the defense as well, so you got to see both sides in the case. But one of the things in particular that I found so interesting was the preparation of the witnesses. As you said, so many of these people were traumatized. I mean, there were a lot of tears shed on the witness stand beforehand that these people, I mean, this was very, very difficult. And I almost every case, at least on camera, you heard one of the prosecutors say, you know, he's going to be, Mladic is going to be in the room. That had to be a very frightening situation. Of course, you go through that with any witness to a crime. But in that case, you know, someone who has killed thousands of people had to be just very traumatic all over again for them.
Yes, it is very scary for them. But one of the things that's common to all of these witnesses is this zeal, this desire to make sure the truth comes out. And I've seen witness after witness make tremendous sacrifices, expose themselves to security risk, to expose themselves to all sorts of hardships, because they survive. They really believe strongly that it's important for the world to know what happened in Bosnia during the war.
How do you track down these witnesses? As you said, that you know, you have to prove thousands of murders. I mean, a lot of it's anecdotal, but you know, it's not like a single murder or two people being killed. How do you do it when there are so many victims?
It's difficult, and it's different for every witness. We're very fortunate to have some of the best investigators in the world, and the U.S. took in a lot of refugees from the Balkans during this time, but so did other countries. Our starting point typically has been trusted journalists. I mean, journalists play such an important role in the work of a war crimes prosecutor because they are the first to report these crimes. Well, then our investigators take them and then try to find the people, try to take statements from them. Sometimes we find them through medical records. Sometimes we find them through municipality records of where they moved. But they've done a marvelous job of tracking down important witnesses and then gaining their trust, because just finding them is only a small part of what we have to do. We have to gain their trust that they are going to come to The Hague and give this evidence.
You know, someone hearing that in this country today when the media is under attack, that is hearing a story about how important the media reports are when it comes to prosecuting war criminals, you know, maybe there are those people who cry fake news and criticize the media, maybe they should take a look at that sometime.
And it's even resonates greater than that, because I investigated Milosevic. Attacks on the media were such an important part of his rise to power. So I'm particularly sensitive to attacks on good journalists doing their best to keep us informed of accurate information.
And I'm sure that there are other victims out there that didn't come forward that you didn't know about. Are you still hearing from some of them?
Yes. So the interesting thing that the Frontline documentary did not show or tell was Elvedin, at the end of his testimony, makes this plea, please help me find my father. And what happened was a number of the perpetrators, now they don't know the names of the people that they shot and killed, but perpetrators came forward and said, I think I know where bodies are. And that's how we got to this Tomasica grave, which features prominently in the documentary, where we found over 500 bodies killed in a very systematic way. So not only are victims and witnesses coming forward, but a lot of other people are coming forward as well. And I think Serbs should be extremely proud of the contribution they've made to the truth in the tribunal. I mean, the victims were primarily Muslim, but they were not able to tell us how the crimes were planned, how they were orchestrated. It's the Serbs that really believed in the truth and came forward and had this desire that the truth come out about what happened in order that it not be repeated.
Mm-hmm. I just heard a story this morning on NPR about trying to recover, maybe not recover is a word, but to gain access to artifacts from people who are victims, families of victims of the Holocaust, because we're losing so many survivors today, 75 years later. And I think back to the Holocaust, and we've heard so many times over the years, never again. Well, unfortunately, there are examples where it does happen again. And the Balkan Wars, what happened in Bosnia, that is a good example of how it continues to happen.
Yes, but the response to what happened in Bosnia was a good one. The Security Council created a court. But now we have this genocide of Rohingyas, and the same compulsion to act is not there. We have Yazidi women who, right, after their husbands and fathers are killed and they're sold as slaves, well, our outrage dissipates a bit more quickly. I think we need to be reminded of what Justice Robert Jackson said at Nuremberg. He said, civilization cannot tolerate these crimes being ignored because it cannot survive survived, they're being repeated. And I think that's an important message that's very important to us today. We have to be very vigilant to prosecute these crimes, prosecute atrocity crimes against victims wherever they occur, no matter what the cost, no matter how politically difficult, because if we don't, as Jackson warns us, it's a threat to our very existence.
That, you say be very vigilant. Why doesn't that vigilance exist with, you mentioned the Yazidi women. Why doesn't that, our interest dissipate? Why?
I'm not sure I have an explanation for that, Scott. That's my perception as a war crimes prosecutor. I have a sense that if the Bosnian conflict came before the Security Council now, that they probably wouldn't establish a court. We've seen these horrors coming out of Syria for several years now, and still there is no court established to hold the perpetrators of these atrocities accountable. So there's this complacency that has set in, and I am certain that those contemplating these crimes, this is not gone unnoticed, and they're emboldened by the idea that the international community is no longer as resolute as it was in ensuring that there's never another atrocity crime or genocide like we had in World War II.
You say that you're not optimistic that if those 1990 crimes would have come, 1990s crimes come before the Security Council today, that there would be something set up to prosecute. Why? I mean, that... I don't know that I hate to hear that.
I mean, John Bolton in September threatened to arrest and prosecute international judges and freeze their assets. The judges at the ICC are eligible to hold the highest court sit on their Supreme Court. And yet now we are threatening independent judges with arrest, with prosecution, freezing their assets. As a war crimes prosecutor, that really scares me that we're approaching a Rubicon that we ought not to cross.
Is it this administration, or has it been trending that way?
I think there's been complacency before this administration, but I think it's unprecedented that we have a senior member of the administration actually voice a threat against judges.
We've talked so much about what's in the news. I mean, just last week, there was the shooting and killing of Muslims in New Zealand. It's not genocide. It's not an international crime. It's an act of terrorism by someone from Australia. But it just goes to show that there are ethnic groups, racial groups that are targeted.
Yes, and I think it's important for us. One of the lessons we've learned is that genocide doesn't start on a single day. It evolves over time. And to the extent that discriminatory crimes are not vigorously prosecuted, it kind of lends to that evolution of genocide. So again, it's very important for domestic prosecutors to ensure that everyone has equal protection of the law and that all infringements of the law directed at particular ethnic groups or religious groups are vigorously prosecuted.
So we only have about 2 minutes left and so much to talk about, but Ratko Mladic kind of got away from him a little bit. So the final outcome, a long trial, long prosecution, long investigation. What happened to Mladic?
We charged him with 11 counts. He was convicted of 10 counts, one count of genocide for what happened in Srebrenica, the killing of over 7,000 men and boys in a matter of days. He was acquitted of one count of genocide, and that's the ethnic cleansing that occurred in Bosnia between 1992 and 1995. We're appealing that. Hopefully we will be successful. The trial chamber gave him a life sentence, and I think myself and my former colleagues are all optimistic that he will retain that life sentence.
When in international law, when someone is sentenced to life, here in the United States, we hear sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Does life mean life internationally?
So what happens in international courts is once the appeal is over, the defendants are sent to the domestic jurisdiction, so typically other countries in Europe. In the beginning, there were some disparities between the two, but I think a great effort has been made to ensure that life does mean life and that there is an automatic good behavior because of the particular country someone was sent to.
I don't know. I have a hard time thinking that Mladic would be an ideal prisoner anyway. I mean, any kind of remorse from this guy? Did not appear as such on camera.
No, I would not say remorse. No, I would not say I ever saw remorse.
When you're in the courtroom with someone like that, what are you thinking? I mean, I know you're doing your job, But the rest of us, when we're watching this, we're thinking this guy is a monster.
And in the beginning, he used to invite me every day for a cup of coffee after court. Of course, I didn't have coffee with him. But he's not a monster. He's a human being who did some really terrible things. And I think if we compartmentalize him as a monster from another planet, we are might miss the human beings that are kind of considering committing awful crimes now.
Mm. Penn State Dickinson School of Law professor Dermot Groom, he was lead prosecutor in the trial of Bosnian Serb war criminal Ratko Mladic. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about Dickinson College and their slavery exhibit. There is a history there. We will talk about that coming up on tomorrow's show. Have yourself a good day. I'm Scott Lamar.